Yay. That was wonderful. Thank you, David. So we're doing a series this fall. It's called Rethinking Religion. It's taking a look at what are the things that have changed within what we call religion, that thing that used to be vital and that now has become more and more irrelevant for so many people. That thing that used to be critical in people's lives and integral and has become, for more and more people, something that is embarrassing or something to be avoided. What is going on? Sometimes churches get on this, and every church should always be rethinking what they do, why they do, rethinking religion, which is the practices, the habits, the beliefs, the rituals that we do to connect with God. We should always be rethinking, and sometimes we see things going on and we think, what are we doing right, wrong? How are we doing that? Perfectly good question, but it goes deeper than that. It goes deeper because there is something that is happening all across the world at this point that is calling into question, which has made some say, let's just give up the whole enterprise altogether. I like better what this church historian said, which is basically that there are historically about every 500 years, society goes through this major shift. The tectonic plates of society shift, and it changes everything, including religion. And the way they said it, it's like about every 500 years, the church has this giant garage sale. And they go through all their things, and they say, what do we want to keep? What do we want to get rid of? What do we want to hang on to? What did we not know we had, but we have now discovered and said, oh, I really want that. What are the things that as we're going up into the attic that we had forgotten that might have new energy? There's a 500-year garage sale. This next month is going to be the 500th anniversary of what was called the Reformation, starting with Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and some of those people. We have been on this 500-year cycle. Is it time to be rethinking everything we do and why we do it? And if so, what should we change? What beliefs should we rethink? What ways of reading the Bible? How do we rethink church? How do we rethink what it means to be a disciple of Christ? How do we worship differently? I know that if I were to take a poll and ask, maybe check off the things that you would like to get rid of, one of the things that would easily go would be this whole idea of confession of sin. Russ, why do we have to do that? It just makes everybody feel guilty. It just chases people away. In my first church, I was doing just a fairly standard confession of sin, reading it out loud, and had somebody after the service come up and take me to task because I was saying things that she didn't agree with and didn't appreciate me lumping her in with everybody else. This was getting in the way. Why do we even have that? I've had that conversation one way or another for more than 30 years. Maybe you have it too. Maybe when you read, we did that unison prayer of confession, maybe you winced this morning. You go, ugh, I don't really like that. Maybe it was one of those things, oh, I wish we didn't do that. Why do we have to do that? It has become something that is synonymous with what makes church look ridiculous, right? It is that thing that when you talk about sin has been used in context with guilt and shame, and it shackles people and it seems to cripple and control people. It is what makes people uptight and fearful and narrow and judging and all those things that we don't like. Why don't we get rid of it? If we don't notice it and think about it because we're coming to church more often than others, we get it, sure hear it from a lot of other people. I'm sure I'm not the only one who has listened to that old song by Billy Joel where he would rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints. And oh, by the way, sinners have much more fun. He's really just echoing what Mark Twain said 100 years before. Go to heaven for the climate, hell for the company. You see, there's something embedded in that, that when we use this word sinner, it has been so overdone and so overused that we just don't believe it anymore. We just don't even know what to do with it anymore. It has been so abused, and I would have to admit, they've got a point. They have a point. But the problem is not this idea of talking about sin. The idea is the way we talk about it. The idea is not confession. It's in the context. I'm going to give you two different ways of thinking about religion this morning. And the first one is one that we were all raised in, that we all had, and it's religion as appeasement. It is appeasing an angry God. It is appeasing and doing the things to get God off our case or so that God won't notice. Last week we talked about the maps, and one of the maps, mental maps in the Bible, in our head at least, is that God is up there. And if God is up there, we have to cajole God. We have to somehow pray and do the kind of things so that God might pay attention to us and might notice us, and then maybe God would answer our prayer and God would come down and fix our whatever it is before God goes back up. But in that same process, we also have a God who's up there who is offended and who's angry. And there's hell to pay, literally. And the story has been told in so many ways that somehow what you have to do and what Christ came to do was to avert the wrath of God. Does that sound familiar to you? It does to me. It does to me because that's how the story is told. I'm told that. I was raised thinking that is the gospel story. It's one way to tell it for sure. It has been told in so many ways where it's epitomized, if you will, by a sermon that was preached in the 1740s. Jonathan Edwards, considered one of the great American philosophers, theologians, and preachers. And the sermon was called Sinner in the Hands of an Angry God. And the idea that if you could paint this picture, if you could impress upon people how much they had offended God, then they would turn and then they would become saved. They would get out of heaven. And so in the midst of this sermon that went on for about an hour, that alone should tank most people, but this phrase, here's a sample. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times more abominable in his eyes than the most hateful, venomous serpent is in ours. And he goes on and then kind of gets to the point. There's more. And it would be a wonder if some that are now present should not be in hell in a very short time before this year is out. Okay, so discovery time's over. We're going to dismiss the children. Back to... Do you get it? Do you get it? What all he has done is he has taken what was there and just amplified it and given it language that, in fact, as people heard this, they would shake, they would convulse, they would wail, and they would give their lives to God looking for the mercy of God. This is religion as appeasement. We do what we do so that God won't be angry with us anymore. There's two places you will find this sermon. There was two places in a single year when I first found this sermon. One was in the Great Sermons of American History. The second place was in a book I was reading at that time for abnormal psychology. True. That this was an example of manipulation. This was an example of casting people and being racked with guilt and shame and what it does to people. In a lot of places, even today, this is called great preaching. In a lot of places today, this is called telling it like it is. And not being afraid to tell people like it is. Except it's not. This isn't like it is. This isn't even close. This is religion as appeasement. This is that way that we control people in the church. This is the way we manipulate people. This is the way we get sacrifice. We get people to be dutiful. This is a way of crippling people. This is a way of shackling people, hurting people. You may have grown up with some of this. Or you'd say, oh, it was never that bad. So we have a kinder, gentler version of that today, but it still has the same idea. There are things that you had better do, otherwise God's not going to love you, accept you. There are things that you, and so religion becomes something we do out of duty and obligation, not because our heart has been warmed and stirred. It's just we're kind of scared not to. We have an angry God who needs to be appeased. God's love is conditional. Whereas that one cartoon I like has the minister telling his congregation, God loves you. Don't let that go to your head. It is that message that it is always conditional. It is always something. Or that God may love you, but God doesn't like you all that much. Or that God's really kind of upset with you. Appeasement religion gets us into these silly mind games, if you've ever heard that, where we're looking for loopholes. Well, what happens if a person, just before, they're terrible their whole life, and just before they die, they say, Jesus, forgive me, I accept you as Lord and Savior. Does that mean they have to get into heaven? Do you hear what underneath all that is? That's a God who needs to be appeased or fooled. We're looking for loopholes. There was a whole approach to evangelism when I was growing up, which said, if you were going to die tonight, are you sure you would go to heaven? And if you got to heaven and God meets you at the gates and said, why should I let you in? What would you say? And there was a right answer and there was a wrong answer. Actually, there were lots of wrong answers and there was one right answer. And the whole point then, so you get to be certain. And religion becomes a way of dispensing certainty to people. But what's underneath that? Is a very uncertain God, a God we have to appease, a God we have to cajole. And so we don't want sin, we don't want confession of sin, because it just reminds us of all of that. We'd rather not bother with that. But then is the answer then that we just don't talk about it at all? No, I don't think it's the issue of sin, I don't think it's the issue of confession. It's the context. It's how it's being used in the context of a religion of appeasement, or the second, which is religion as alignment. The habits, the practices, the beliefs, the rituals we do help us align with who God is and what God is doing as we understand God through Jesus Christ. That Jesus Christ is the face of God. This shows who not only who God is, but it shows us who we are to be as well. Christ is the true human. And we look there, and our life is to align and line up with what God is doing and what God values. And this is how life flows. From Christ, we know that God is a God of love. And so sin, which is real, is a violation of love. Loving God, loving our neighbor. Listen to those words again that we said this morning. Listen to how it is, not as a way of appeasing God, but as a way of recognizing how we are out of alignment with God. Merciful God, we confess that we have sinned against you in thought and word and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. We haven't loved you with our whole heart, mind, and strength. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We're out of alignment. We're out of alignment with the way God created us. But we don't find an angry God. We find a God who is seeking and loving. There is a phrase that is in our passage, and the reason I chose this one, even though there's parts of this passage that most people don't like to hear, me included, to be honest, because they've been misused so many times. And it's this little phrase called, but God. But God. It's amazingly consistent with the early preaching of the church. Look in the book of Acts sometime, and right after Jesus rose from the dead, the people who were closest to Jesus, the people who walked with Jesus, the people who experienced the resurrection, when they preach, you will never hear anything about an angry God. You'll never hear about us being loathsome in the mind of God or in the eyes of God. What you will hear, and it's very consistent all throughout, and it's consistent in this passage as well, it just carries through, it goes something like this. So God was involved in the world, and God has been waiting to save the world. And so God sent his Messiah, and you killed the Messiah. So God's really angry with you. That's not what it says. You killed the Messiah, but God raised him from the dead. One of the times the sermon goes, you killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead. It goes something like this. You rejected God. Through the resurrection, God rejected your rejection. It wasn't going to stand. Now, align your life with God, what God is still doing. What are we to do? Turn around, change the direction. You are out of alignment with what God is doing. So listen to it, how it shows up in Ephesians. It's the same pattern. You were dead through the trespasses and sins in which you once lived, following the course of this world, following the ruler of the power of the air, the spirit that's now at work among those who are disobedient. Jump down a few verses, a few words. We were by nature children of wrath like everyone else. We can't point to everybody else and say they're the problem. No, that's us too. We're all in. Our life is a hot mess. We're out of alignment with what God is trying to do and what we were created for. We say that and we acknowledge that so we can hear this. But God, who is rich in mercy and out of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead through our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace, you have been saved. Confession is critical, not so that we can appease God, but so that we can acknowledge our life is out of alignment, so that we get to participate in the great story of but God, who's rich in mercy, is still at work and is still doing things, and it's completed. It's completed in Paul's mind, and it's not an add-on. It's completed. Your life is aligned now with God. So, as he talks about, he says, for we are what he has made us, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand to be our way of life. Do you see the connection? Our life was out of alignment. God's rich in mercy. He's making us whole. He's healing. He's saving. And now you're ready because your whole life was meant to be a source of good. You were created for good. And when you are, it's not being good so that God will like you better, so that God will not be angry with you. We're being good because that's the closest thing we know through Christ to be our truest nature. It's so that we embody and extend the love of God in and through our lives. And it changes the way we do everything. It may be too simplistic to say it's either going to be, we're either going to follow the religion of appeasement or the religion of alignment. It may be too simplistic, but I don't think that's too far off. The longer I do what I do, I find people who are following one path, and if it's still bearing this burden of somehow trying to appease a God, or through the representatives of God, their parents or other authority figures, and if they're still trying to work with that, their life gets smaller, it is still heavy, it is still shackled. As people understand that their life is meant to be aligned with God, their life opens up and they become more and more a vessel of what is good and right and whole. They get to be part of the solution. It changes the way we do with each other. Rather than trying to find scapegoats, rather than trying to find all the reasons things are wrong with the world so we don't have to deal with our own stuff, we get to come with openness and transparency and grace. We get to embody that. I've told this story before, but it's one of the most formational in my early years in ministry. It's your first church I was at, and I was given an assignment. I was going to do it, and I didn't do it. I dropped the ball. And I had a very weak way of trying to explain this and trying to get around it. I think I said, boy, I feel like I have
feel like I've dropped the ball. Maybe that's exactly what I said. To which the minister there, my boss, just looked at me and goes, well, you did. But we love you. I can't tell you how transformational that was. I didn't have to make excuses. I didn't have to justify myself. I didn't have to find all the reasons that didn't work. It just changed the whole tone of that staff. It changed the tone of that relationship I had. I was no longer trying to figure out ways to make sure or hide things that were broken. It became a way of saying, look, I blew it. I didn't do what I was saying I was going to do. I'm sorry. But that's okay. We love you. Do you hear it again? Our life was out of alignment. But God, we get to embody that. We get to be the face of God. We get to be the representation of either the God who always is judging and always is where it's never enough, or we get to be the God of the loving embrace. So it's a 500-year garage sale, and there are some things we should hang on to, and I think the idea of confession is one of them. Because it's through confession we get to hear the assurance of God's love. We get to be part of it. But there are some things we should. I think we should. It's time to shelve and get rid of the language and the use of this God of appeasement, this religion of appeasement. Let's get rid of the angry God. Let's get rid of that. It may have made sense at one point. Maybe it made sense. But so did double-knit leisure suits at one point. I saw a picture this last week of many years ago. I was wearing bell-bottom pants. It may have made sense at one point. But God is rich in mercy. There are some things that can help. There are some things that can help. Change the way we think, change the way we act. Next week we're talking about the power of community. But then there are some things that also help in the way we think and approach God. And that's where one of those things that I think has been up in the attic for so many years, this at least for most of us noisy Protestants, this contemplative prayer, this idea of something that's been there, was discarded, stuck in a trunk, is like, oh, that's never going to work. And yet for myself and for many, more and more people are finding that to be a source of rearranging the way that we think and experience God. That's why throughout this series we are taking some time at the end of each sermon to do a practice of abiding prayer. Leanne's here this morning from that group called Growing Everyday Spirituality, and she's going to lead us in one more of those practices. And it's just a sample, it's just a taste to give us. And if you want more, there's lots of literature out there on the table. But this isn't disconnected. This is integral to the way that we live into a religion that helps align us with who God is and who God's creating us to be.
You're on it. Good morning. It's nice to see you for the third week. We've been looking at abiding prayer practices, which is just another way of talking about contemplative or inner prayer. The point of abiding prayer is to find a still place within you and to resonate towards that in your own prayer life. We talked about in Matthew, when Matthew says, when Jesus says, when you pray, go away by yourself. Shut the door behind you and pray to your Father in private. And the challenge has been, how do we do that? Because so many of us have busy lives, and that's overflowing.